for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Every family has secrets. In Beth Luxenberg's family, the secrets lasted a lifetime. Only after her death did Beth's children discover she had a sister, Annie, just 2 years younger than she. Annie lived with their parents until early adulthood, but spent the rest of her life in the care of the state of Michigan. Beth's son, Steve Luxenberg, a Washington Post editor, writes about his investigation into his family's past in a new book. It's titled Annie's Ghosts. He's here in the studio with me, and we'll take your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to you, Steve.
Good morning, Diane.
As I said at the start, I do think every family has its secrets, and many families are comfortable just letting them go.
I think that's right.
You weren't.
No. When we first heard about the secret, it was actually a couple of years before my mom died that we heard the first whispers of it. But what we heard wasn't true.
What did you hear?
My mother had been sick, and she was being treated for emphysema. And when that happened, her anxiety level was so high that the hospital decided that she should be consulted with a psychiatrist. He wasn't doing therapy. He was doing a routine family history with her, and she mentioned that she had a disabled sister who was 2 years old, and my mom was four when she went away to the institution. My mom didn't tell us, so we didn't feel it was appropriate to ask her directly about it. We thought she might feel betrayed, and besides, why would it make a difference? She didn't know what happened to her sister.
You mean, how did you learn, though? Did the doctor tell you? Were you in the room when she said it?
No, she was alone, and a social worker who had been told by my mom, as she told everyone, that she was an only child. The social worker called my sister one April afternoon, which is where the book begins, and says, "Did your mother have a sister?" And my sister said, "No, why are you asking?" And so my sister, of course, did the first thing that came to mind, which was to call me and ask me if I knew. And I, of course, didn't know. And then we let it go. I mean, amazingly enough, here I am, a journalist. We let this amazing fact go because we thought it would just yield nothing. And then my mom died in 99. And then 6 months later, a letter that had obviously gone to her every year came to my brother because the mail was being forwarded. And it was an ordinary letter from a cemetery asking if we wanted to have flowers planted on my brother, on my grandparents' graves. But instead of listing two graves, it listed three. And this time the secret had a name, which was Annie. And then, as you said in your intro, when I pursued it, what I learned was that my mom was not four and her sister was not two. She was 23 and my sister was 21 when she was involuntarily committed to a Michigan hospital.
It turned out that, as you said, your mother always introduced herself as an only child. She made a big deal out of that.
A huge deal out of it. I mean, if she were in this room with us, she'd find a way to tell you in the first 10 minutes that she was an only child.
She was an only child.
And you think about that, how often do we talk about our siblings on first introduction? We don't. And so I think my analysis is that she was kind of controlling the story before it began.
And she talked about the privileges, the specialness of being an only child.
Yeah, she bonded with my wife, then my girlfriend, on their first meeting because my wife truly is an only child. And she said, "I know how it is to grow up an only child." And so this is the kind of image. I have vivid images of the story she's told about living in a walk-up apartment, you know, reading alone, going to school alone, just her and her grandparents. So I had no place to fit this idea of a 21-year-old who had grown up with my mom.
But I think from the way you tell the story, it's clear that you would have been reluctant to put it to your mom. while she was still alive.
I think if it came out in a natural way, I wouldn't have been reluctant, but I was reluctant to, quote, confront her. I mean, this is not 60 Minutes, and I'm not investigating my own mother.
Yeah.
Although I think some people think the book is a kind of investigation of my mom. That's kind of a fun thing. But after, you know, somebody asked me, if your mom were still alive, would you have written this book? And I said, not this book. This book starts with her death. It starts with the ability to go back and try to recreate the world that she lived in to see what were the choices that she made in 1940 when Annie was institutionalized. What was she thinking? If she were still alive, I would be talking with her, and if it somehow led to an article, you know, I'm a journalist, it somehow led to an article, it would be her story to tell, not mine. This is my detective work to tell her story.
Steve Luxenberg, he's been a senior editor with the Washington Post for 22 years. His new book is titled Annie's Ghosts, A Journey into a Family Secret. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Do you think your father knew about Annie?
Well, that's a good question. It's the question I start my investigation with. You know, when two people live together, as my parents did for their entire married life, my father was married once before, but they were married for nearly 40 years. I couldn't believe that he didn't know. So part of my search is to answer that question. Part of my real search was, what was my mother's motivation here? That was one goal of writing the book. The second goal was, could I restore Annie's identity to her? One of the main themes of the book is the question of identity. You know, we're given a name when we're born. Identity is very important to us. I never questioned my mother's biography when I was growing up. In her 40s, you know, her name was Beth. She was an only child, and she always told us to tell the truth. Well, her name wasn't Beth, we learned. Her name was Bertha, and she obviously wasn't an only child, and she didn't tell the truth. So my image of my mom, who is a very loving, kind, and generous person, raised five children, including three of her own children and two stepchildren, and, you know, pretty successfully, this was a shock to me. And so I was curious if I could figure out, why had she done this? And what were the consequences to her and to others around her? At the end of her life, she was quite needy in a way that I was not comfortable with. And I now know it was related, I think, to the burden of carrying this secret, which she wanted to let go but just couldn't.
When you say she became needy, of all your siblings, or particularly of you?
Well, she was still working. She worked until the time, really, that she, about a year before her death, 78 years old, she was being treated for depression. She would communicate her neediness by asking if you loved her. Do you love me? Well, of course, we loved her dearly, and we told her so frequently. No one likes to be asked for that love. You want to be able to give it freely. And so, not physically, because I saw her quite a bit, as did the rest of my siblings, but emotionally, I found myself pushing her away a little bit. The book has brought me closer to her. Closer to her because I now have gotten to know a woman that I could not have known because I wasn't alive. The woman who was 25 years old in 1942 when the secret begins to be created. And think about the secret. She's in a neighborhood. Everybody knows her. Everybody knows my aunt. Who's she keeping it a secret from? So some people have suggested to me that shame is what this is all about. Oh, she was ashamed of her sister. Well, certainly that was part of it, but shame is really where the story begins, not where it ends.
Tell us about Annie.
Annie was born, unfortunately, with a deformed leg. And so for the first 15 years of her life, she was really characterized not by the slight mental retardation that she was judged to have, but by the physical problems. So when you saw her, she was always in a cast or a brace as they tried to straighten her leg. She was born in 1919, and there weren't the knowledge that we have now of how to do this. Her leg was never straight, and eventually it began, I understand from talking to experts, began to contract, and it became a dead weight. You know, she's really walking on that one leg that's good and not on both. She had trouble getting around, but she did go to school. She learned to read, and then at the age of 17, her leg was amputated. The question is, of course, as a journalist, is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? And I interview experts who thought that what the doctor was trying to do, and he was the foremost orthopedic surgeon in Detroit, which is where the story takes place, that he was trying to give her a stable platform to walk. And so she got a wooden leg, which, according to the hospital records I obtained, quote, never fitted very well. And she had trouble walking after that. At the age of 19, she began to develop symptoms of paranoia. And by the age of 21, my grandmother was being advised, according to the records, that she should be committed involuntarily to an institution because she said, I'm not insane.
She said, I'm not insane.
She said to the people who interviewed her that I'm not insane. And at that time, you know, her time in the mental institution is a fascinating one. When I first called the state of Michigan to find out about that time, I got a woman in Lansing, which is the state capital, and I asked her, I just learned about my aunt. I'd like to find out something about her. And she said, you and 5,000 other people. And I said, wait a minute, deinstitutionalization occurred 30 years ago. This is the year 2000. Why 5,000 other people? And she said, I get dozens of calls a month from people who say they've just learned that they had a relative who was in the mental institution. And I say, what can you tell them? And she said, I can't tell them anything because state law prohibits me. You need a court order to get the records.
Did you have to go through that whole process?
I found a way around it that did involve getting an effective court order. I became, through what I call a double bank shot, the executive of my mother's estate, because my mother then could be judged the executor of my aunt's estate. And so armed with these letters that they give you, these letters of authority, I was allowed to look at medical records for both of my mother and for Annie. It took me a long time before I started actually researching the story. I learned this in 2000, but I didn't start until 2006 because I thought it was going to be something that I needed to do full time, and I had a job that I was doing, and I waited until I thought it was the appropriate moment.
Steve Luxenberg will continue with his story all about his book titled Annie's Ghosts when we come back after a short break. If you've just joined us, Steve Luxenberg is an editor with the Washington Post. He uncovered a story about his mother, his family, that he had no idea of until his mother died. His mother, whose name was Beth, had a sister whose name was Annie. And Steve's book is titled Annie's Ghosts, A Journey into a Family's Secret. You can join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. I wonder how many people actually knew about Annie.
It turns out a fair number of them knew. My mother at one point was in a bridge group, and I now know that the entire bridge group knew, but they didn't talk about it with each other because that was the culture of the time. Secrecy was not only allowed, but it was actually honored. And I've thought a lot about secrets and whether you should keep them or not. Of course, secrecy is just the other side of privacy. I mean, we shouldn't be required to live our lives as open books for anybody to read. So you're allowed to keep some things private, and you're allowed to even keep some things secret. So the calculus I thought for myself was, if a secret hurts you, or hurt somebody else that you love, then maybe you ought to consider that it's time to release it.
Mm.
And I think my mother was hurting from her secret. She stood in this psychiatric ward in 1995 when she was being asked to be voluntarily committed for 2 weeks by a psychiatrist who did not feel comfortable giving her medication for her depression because she was an emphysema sufferer and the medication had a respiratory suppressant risk, just a risk. And we all agreed that she would go there, and then the next morning she called and said, "Stephen, you have to come and take me out of here. I cannot stay here. You do not understand." And of course it was a place that I wouldn't want to be in, demented people around you, etc. We got there, and it was really the worst day of my life.
Really?
It really was. My mother was pleading with me, cajoling me, begging me, hugging me. I felt like the parent. She was the child. She was manipulating me and saying, "You have to take me out of here. You don't understand. I can't stay here." And of course, I didn't understand. But had she told me, "I'm my sister. You're recreating my sister. Don't leave me here. Don't abandon me as I abandoned my sister," then I would have understood.
Where did she go when you brought her back?
She went back to her apartment. The medication was working. She went back to work. She went back to driving herself down Detroit's wonderful expressways. And she lived another 3 years. She got healthy enough that we could have asked her about the secret, but as I said before, we decided not to. We decided that it would seem like a betrayal, and besides, at that point, all we knew is that she had a sister, not that she had lived with her sister. I thought she had not. She was 2 years old when she went off to the institution, and my mom didn't know what happened to her.
So you, in your investigative reporting, found out about Eloise Hospital. Tell us about Eloise.
Well, Eloise is a remarkable place, a metaphor for the kind of mental health system that we had in the 1940s. It was a little city, 10,000 residents, 5,000 psychiatric patients, 5,000 either infirm or homeless. During the Depression, and there's a parallel now in Detroit undergoing its terrible problems with the auto industry. The auto industry went into the tank immediately after the crash of the stock market. 125,000 people put out of work in the first year. Another 100,000 put out in the second year. The remaining third of the workforce was working part-time. There were so many homeless people, they had to put them somewhere, so they built a Pentagon-style barracks at Eloise. And Eloise, at one point, swelled in the winter to 7,000 homeless people next to the 5,000 psychiatric patients. It thought of it itself as a progressive place, hiring the best and the brightest from Michigan's universities. And one of the things that I discovered about the mental health system is that every generation thinks that it's doing better than the last. Mm. Every generation thinks that it's improving. It's making it more humane. And I wonder, of course, 50 years from now, whether they'll look back at what we do today with our homeless people under the expressways, with our mentally ill in prisons in some counties, because they've committed a crime, but because they got no treatment, no place for them to go, no hospitals.
Closing of St. Elizabeth's here.
Closing. I'll give you a statistic. In 1955, the United States reached the peak of the mental health inpatient population, 558,000 people in psychiatric patients. Today, we have fewer than 50,000. Mm-hmm. And yet the country's population has doubled. That calculation doesn't work. Either we should have 1 million or we never should have had 558,000. So I think we just have not yet reached the right equilibrium for how we should be treating the mentally ill.
Was Annie in that psychiatric portion of Eloise?
She was there for 31 years. Mm-hmm. First sent there on a temporary detention, which is why I think my mother, when she was told that she would be there for 2 weeks, maybe Annie was supposed to only be there for 2 weeks, and it turned into 31 years. And of course, fear is not rational. So my mother was fearful on that day in 1995. I can't learn as much as I'd like to know about Annie. I can't get all the records. But what I did learn about Annie is that she became a kind of custodial patient, which tells you a lot about the cultural forces of the time. A psychiatrist who worked there for 30-plus years, I interviewed him, and I said, "Tell me about why she would have become custodial." A word that we use more vividly might be warehoused.
Yeah.
And the reason is that the family didn't know what to do with her. They didn't know how to take care of her. They were impoverished. She was in a public institution. Secondly, where would she go if she were sent to live on her own? She didn't have a job. women didn't have many opportunities in those days.
We don't know whether she could handle money at all.
We don't know that, although she could read, and I think the experts I've consulted think that she could have held a job. She could have lived in a group home today. But she would have lived with a group home today with a lot of support.
Yes.
Back then, you know, going out on her own to find a job, impossible. So she couldn't live. She actually told the social worker who interviewed her at the entrance to the hospital, at the entry to the hospital, I want to be independent. I want to have a job. I think that shows a kind of insight that a lot of people who are retarded would not show at that time. I don't like the word retarded. Developmentally disabled, we would use now. But in those days, the language, you know, the residents of Eloise were inmates. That was the term.
So the notes that you retrieved indicate that she said, I want to be independent. I want to hold a job.
That's exactly what she said. And she also said something that I was scared to interpret, because I thought it showed the paranoia that she was alleged to have. She said, everybody wants to see me in my coffin. Now think about that. That's not a rational thing to say, and that's not the way people think. But I learned something that is very telling about the time, and it has to do with the eugenics movement. When my aunt was born in 1919, the story went around the neighborhood, according to one person I interviewed, that the doctor who delivered her at home, not in a hospital, turned to my grandmother and said, I can take care of this right now, when she saw the deformed leg, when he saw the deformed leg. And of course, my grandmother said no, and Annie went on to live her life. Well, everybody in the neighborhood knew that, according to this woman. Everybody knew this story. And even if it isn't true, I mean, I don't know if the doctor really said that.
Yeah.
That might have been created years after the fact. Yeah. But if everyone believed it to be true, and Annie believed it to be true, then saying they all want to see me in my coffin isn't far from the truth. In the 1919 era, there was a huge debate in the country, a Kevorkian-style debate, because a doctor named Hazelden actually made a public show of refusing to intervene when intervention would have saved the lives of newborns if he thought they were too deformed to have a productive life. He went on to make a film about this called The Black Stork, in which he advertised his eugenicist views. A huge debate ensued. Helen Keller even weighed in the New Republic on his side, if you can believe that. And what she wrote was, in the case where the deformity was so great that the child would have no shot at a productive life, she said, quote, no one cares about these useless lumps of clay. She favored having a scientific board that would judge whether life or death ought to occur. So that's the kind of debate that was going on publicly in America.
Right.
That debate came back in the 1930s as euthanasia was really discussed for the first time. And, of course, the Nazis had their own eugenicist program. So I suddenly thought, well, maybe Annie wasn't so paranoid after all. I mean, she showed paranoia in other ways, I should be clear. She didn't want to leave the house. She stood on the curb for an hour, refused to cross the street. She claimed that people were coming to get her. And she also alleged that she had been sexually assaulted.
She alleged.
She alleged.
We don't know.
Don't know for sure. The social worker reported that she said that. But there was no police report. I could not find one. The family didn't know whether it was true.
Of course, there wouldn't necessarily have been a police report.
And so all I have is the social worker's notes that say that she had alleged this. But this is a woman who people were pulling at her leg her whole life. Mm. And as one therapist said to me, this is a woman whose space was violated from a very early age. She had no privacy. And so it's not surprising that she developed symptoms of mental illness in this therapist's view.
Do we have records of how she behaved within the institution and whether your mother, her mother, and father came to visit?
We do have records of that. The secret was my mother's. It was not my grandparents'. My grandparents told their generation. They knew all about Annie. In fact, when a relative came to the country after surviving the Holocaust, my grandmother enlisted her to drive her to Eloise in the 1950s instead of having to take the two buses that my grandmother needed to take, which took her more than an hour. So I know that my grandmother visited her on a regular basis. This cousin of mine, whose name is also Anna, she told me about those visits and what Annie looked like. She described her for me. She was short, she had curly hair, and she also would cling to her mother as soon as my grandmother would arrive. My grandmother would bring her food. I said, food? Why food? The hospital was obviously feeding her, but I gather it was one way for them to bond. But my Aunt Annie didn't want to see Anna. She wanted only to see her mother, to the point where Anna actually was asked to stay outside and let the two of them visit alone. As to my mother's visits, it says expressly in the records that my mother did not visit her. And this is a shock to me. It made me think about my mother in a different way, because my mother was a kind and generous person who loved to show how kind and generous she really was. She knew that you got points for that. And so she would have gone to visit her sister in the hospital, but the fact that she was keeping it a secret meant, of course, that she couldn't do that.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show, and we've got many callers. Let's open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Tulsa, Oklahoma. Good morning, Mary. You're on the air.
Good morning, and I love the show. Listen to it all the time.
Thank you.
I have a question because on my father's deathbed, a secret that my mother and father had kept for years, ironically, about my mother's prior marriage was revealed to her children for the first time. That created quite a stir in my family among my siblings, one of whom was very, very angry that the secret was kept in the first place. It seemed very stupid, and frankly, I mean, it explained a lot of her behavior, their behavior. And I was wondering if you had any of that when you discovered the identity or the fact that you had an aunt.
In my own family, there was some discussion about whether I should pursue the story. My older brother was not as keen as the rest of us on it. I write in the book that in my family, the past wasn't just past, it was irrelevant. We were a modern American family. We were going forward, not looking backward. And he didn't see that I could really ever stand in my mother's shoes. He thought that it was just not possible. He wasn't saying that I would fail just as much as that, you know, it's an impossibility. The deathbed confession is one that I think is an interesting problem, because it's the confessor's desire to unburden him or herself often and leaving behind a legacy that I think that's a secret that might well have gone to the grave, and it would have been better for your family. I don't know that it would have helped, but I don't know nothing about the circumstances to know. But I think that a secret should be dealt with when it's possible for the family to deal with its consequences. And so revealing it on the deathbed is a kind of question of integrity. Almost.
I should say, I think I'm going to make a sweeping statement here, but I think secrets within families can be among the most destructive elements in any relationship. I think they inevitably come out somehow. There is no secret in a family that can be kept forever.
Well, in fact, in the first sentence of my book, I say secrets have a way of working free of their keepers.
Absolutely.
My mother obviously didn't intend for this letter to come to us from the cemetery. And I think they can be extremely destructive and have lifelong consequences. I know of one person who discovered that she was a secret, in effect. That is, that she went to look for a birth certificate, and there wasn't one, and it had to do with a secret in her own family. And so that unleashed a whole number of things. Now, in my case, secret wasn't being done to me. I mean, it wasn't really my story. I never knew my aunt. So I didn't feel any anger at my mother, the way this caller said that she, one family member had anger. But I think it affected the relationship between my mother and me, and in the sense that I couldn't help her with her situation. And the fact that she felt, judged? She felt that she would be judged poorly by her own children. That's a very strong motivation. If she could stand there and say, Stephen, you don't understand, you can't leave me here, the next sentence should have been, and here's why.
Yeah.
And yet she couldn't bring herself, after all this time, to reveal it.
But then, Stephen, the question has to be, How has learning all this affected your thinking about your mother?
Well, it affected me in two ways. One, I understand much, much better what it was like in that era to be faced with the questions that she had. My mother really reinvented herself. She left her neighborhood. She left behind her identity. She changed her name to, she was always calling herself Beth. She wanted a different life, but her secret became, her quest for freedom from the life that she was leaving behind became a trap. She was imprisoned by her secret the same way Annie was kind of imprisoned by the hospital. As for my own personal feeling, ironically, I feel closer to my mother today than I felt at the time of her death.
Knowing, as you do, what she had gone through.
Knowing.
Stephen Luxenberg, his book is titled Annie's Ghosts. And we'll take a short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR.
A rebroadcast of our readers' review of Maurice Sendak's classic, Where the Wild Things Are. Join me for a discussion of the beloved children's tale about Max, monsters, and making mischief of one kind or another. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And if you've just joined us, Steve Luxenberg is with me. He has a new book all about a sister of his mother's who spent truly just about a lifetime in an involuntary confinement within an institution in Michigan. Here's an email from Donald who says, I would like to obtain the medical records from my involuntary hospitalization at Northville State Hospital in 1960. I've got nothing but a runaround. What specific agency in Lansing must I contact in order to force disclosure of these records?
Northville State Hospital happened to be the second hospital that Annie spent time in for just a four-month period. So there's a link here between Donald's story and mine. There are two routes to getting some information. The first is, if he were involuntarily committed, there had to be a court record. It had to be done through a court proceeding. Northville, I believe, is in Wayne County. Therefore, he can go to the Wayne County Probate Court, and he can ask for the file under his name. And he will get the records of the court proceeding, not the medical records, but the court proceeding. Then he should go to the Department of Community Health in Lansing, not go necessarily, but contact them. And there is a form that he can fill out that says, I authorize you to release records to me. It sounds crazy, but that's the way in which it's done. And then the question, though, is, are the records in existence? Because in 1960, the state had a 20-year records retention policy at the time that Northville closed in 2003, and they destroyed Annie's records, and I didn't get that portion. I don't know whether Donald's records still exist. The court records will definitely exist.
You know, I am so struck by the face page here where there is a copy of a receipt. State of Michigan, probate court for the county of Wayne in the matter of Annie Cohen, an alleged insane person. Application for admission to the hospital, May 8, 1940. It's that word, alleged insane person. Did they ever establish that she was insane and belonged there?
The state law at the time required that two doctors examine Annie, and they disagreed, which was rare because I looked at a number of other cases to see how often there was a split. One of them said she should be institutionalized and that she was, quote, actually insane. There's a form that you filled out and you would give your description of it. No diagnosis was required. They did not need to say the kind of mental illness that she had. They just needed to state that she was actually insane. So a third physician was asked to examine her by the judge, and he said, quote, she could use a little treatment, end quote. And on that basis, she was confined. Now, I should say, I do believe that she was showing symptoms of mental illness, but I don't believe that she needed to be confined for the rest of her life.
Do we know how she behaved within the hospital?
I know that how she behaved in, as seen by Anna, my cousin, and by others who had visited her with my grandmother. She continued to show this kind of paranoia. She did not want others around. She wanted to be with her mother. But, of course, she was being confined to a mental institution.
Well, yeah.
So I think it's very hard to calibrate her behavior. Mm. I know that as late as 1960, she entered in 1940, as late as 1960, she was still able to communicate with her mother and talk. But in 1972, when she was being evaluated for deinstitutionalization, and she was at Northville now because she'd been transferred from Eloise, the social worker wrote that she is, quote, largely irrelevant. Now, that word, in common everyday usage, causes your heart to palpitate.
Yes.
But I think what he meant was she doesn't participate in her surroundings. Well, by 1972, she had been on medication. And for what? Not clear. Medication for probably more than a dozen years. And she had Parkinsonians, which is a sort of faux tremor that's caused by being on the particular long-term medication that she was given.
Did they finally release her, or did she die within the hospital?
She was released to a nursing home, and she spent 4 months there, and that's where she died. The other thing that happened to her was in 1945, the overcrowding at Eloise was so, so great. There's a picture in the book of women sleeping on the floor, patients sleeping on the floor in a female ward, that she was among 160 patients transferred 600 miles away to the Upper Peninsula to stay in a temporary mental hospital that was in a former army barracks that was being decommissioned. Mm. And the superintendent, in a letter that was unearthed by somebody who was looking for these kinds of records for me, described her as able to get around and take care of herself. Not exactly the picture of somebody who's irrelevant 30 years later, so you see the deterioration from 1945 to 1972.
It must have been difficult when your grandmother stopped showing up.
My grandmother died in 1966, and as far as I can tell, my mother did not visit her from 1966 until she died in 1972. But my mother did take care of her burial arrangement, and amazingly enough, according to the records at the cemetery, there was a service of some sort. And I actually,
how old would you have been at the time?
I was a sophomore in college, and I was home from college, and this all took place without my knowledge or any of my siblings' knowledge.
How could that be?
She, you know, it's remarkable. If you think about it, you have to have a lot of stamina and cleverness to carry off this deception. I found the rabbi who was, he in the record says that he was the person who did the service, and there was, of course, nobody there at the service. It wasn't held in a public way like memorial services. But he said that I must have conducted one because I have the records of myself, and I made that note.
Here's a caller in Jacksonville, Florida. Good morning, David. You're on the air.
Well, thank you for taking my call. And it's a fascinating story, and I'm glad to say mine isn't quite as tragic, but my father was the secret in the sense that he didn't find out he was adopted by his aunt until he tried to go into World War II. And again, looking for looking for his birth certificate. And all of a sudden he found out he wasn't who he thought he was. And it was a big secret growing up in my life that we never knew any of this. And then he found genealogy, and everything opened up. And I remember about 10 years ago, he came into town and says, I'm going down the road, and I'm going to introduce myself to my sister who doesn't know I exist. And he ended up having three different sisters from both sides of the family. And it's turned out to be nothing but a good thing. But one of the interesting things I will say is it's amazing how the genetics works when – you never knew a different family existed, and then when you do get together, how family characteristics are carried through. And, you know, it was just a surprise.
I should say. David, it sounds as though you've got your own story to write. Thanks so much for calling. Let's go to Glen Arbor, Michigan. Good morning, Susan.
Thank you, Diane, for taking my call. And Stephen, I am just thrilled to hear of your story, Annie's ghost. I have the brother of my father who also had a very similar experience in his life with involuntary confinement. He was an epileptic, had suffered from petite mal as a child, and then as he matured and went through his young teenage years, it became grand mal. He came from a very prominent Detroit family. My grandfather was an attorney, highly placed in the community, and my grandmother was a teacher. He had my father, who was his younger brother by 3 years, and then another brother 3 years younger. They were all overachievers and athletes. And my uncle was had some issues at home related to aggression with toward my grandmother, so my grandfather reluctantly admitted him also through Eloise to Northville to Carroll State Hospital, and he eventually ended up in Traverse City. And as a senior citizen was in a group home the last 7 years of his life. Yeah. He had a best friend named Annie, who ours was not a family secret because uncle was born in 1929, and I believe he was admitted into the system approximately 1945. And my grandfather died in 1956. He spent every weekend with my uncle. And then in 56, my father took my sister and I to visit my uncle.
At Eloise? At Eloise?
Yes, he was it.
Did you visit at Eloise?
Yes, he was. I was a very young child at the time, so I don't know if it was Eloise, but I know that he was there for quite some time, and then moved to Northville State Hospital, and then to Carroll State Hospital. And I have vivid memories of Carroll State Hospital. And my uncle was not mentally impaired except for this physical ailment of his grand mal seizures, which every time left him devastated when he would have these seizures. And then they started really heavily medicating him to a point where he became not real functional, but he was a great artist, and he entertained people there by drawing. He could draw anything, and we always said if you could draw a running horse, you could really draw, you know. So he was always drawing pictures for people. And it was not a family secret. We all knew about it, but it was a social stigma for families. For some reason, at least in the circles in Detroit, I know.
Well, not just Detroit. No. I think really all over the country, this idea of difficulty either with epilepsy, with a shrunken leg, a wooden leg, deformity translated into difficulty.
Tomorrow morning, here in Washington at St. Elizabeth's, there's going to be a ceremony that is commemorating all of the people buried anonymously in cemeteries near mental hospitals, anonymously because they couldn't afford gravestones, etc. At Eloise, there's a cemetery where there's 7,144 people buried under numbered markers.
Wow.
And they were buried there from 1910 to 1948. These were the people whose families didn't come to claim them. There's a movement called Resurrecting Voices. That's part of this movement. The ceremony tomorrow is sponsored by a mental health group. It's been 2 years in the making. I'm not involved in it. I've been invited to be a guest at it. But I know that all over the country, there were these very, very large, huge mental institutions. Back in the 19th century, when New York said they were going to build one for 3,000 patients, there was a huge outcry about that being too large, but it eventually was built. It was inexorable because the standard in those days was, we owe you, we the state, owe you care and treatment. We owe you care and treatment for our defective population. Yeah. In the 1960s, the Supreme Court adopted a different standard, 1970 era, which was you needed to be a danger to yourself and to others before you could be involuntarily committed. That's a huge difference.
At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Here's an email from Deborah, who says, when I first read Steve's book, I was pretty sure the reason his mother kept her sister a secret was about marriageability. It would have been hard for her to find a man willing to marry into a family with a handicapped sibling. Later, though, I thought of Steve's book when I was talking to a woman who had severed all ties with her own sister. She said she made this decision when her own child was born, and she realized she did not want this innocent child's life sullied by her difficult sister, as her own had been. Suddenly I realized it's likely Beth Luxenberg was protecting her own children from the pain she herself had suffered growing up because of Annie. The word sully seems to be key.
I think that that's an interpretation that is a good one. If you think about the secret as having four or five lives. That is, maybe my mother created the secret for one reason. She kept it 10 years out for a second reason. She then kept it after Annie's death for a third reason. But think about how is my life sullied in 1995 by my mother keeping the secret then? So I don't think my mother intended to keep the secret her whole life. I think that it became something that was larger than she was.
So you believe that had Annie been born, say, in 1950, her life would have been totally different?
Probably not 1950. I think that more likely 1970 or 80. 1950, she would have been 21 in 1970.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the experts that I've talked to like to reassure me that if intervention had occurred at a younger age, if she was recognized that she needed psychological help, yeah, not just her deformed leg, but her deformed leg was causing psychological
problems,
When would that have been? I'm not quite sure, but I would certainly they would say in the year 2009 we would recognize that there would be a tremendous toll taken. I interviewed a prosthetics expert, and he told me that we all bond with our body limbs by the age of 8 or 9. So if you think about that, then all the amputations should be done before that. Now, he wasn't making a scientific statement. He was just making the psychological observation that when you lose a limb as a teenager, you feel like you've lost a part of yourself.
I would think you would like to have met Annie.
I would have, actually. Although I think that the caller's question implies that it might have been difficult for me to handle it as a teenager. As an adult, I would have liked to have met her.
Steve Luxenberg. The book is titled Annie's Ghosts. Congratulations.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having
Thanks
me.
Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.